Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabella Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work, people who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
Welcome to From Idea to Impact. I'm Jessica Love, a managing director at Arabella Advisors, and I'm excited to share a conversation I had with Amaka Agbo. She's the CEO of the Katali Foundation and the director of the Restorative Economies Fund. We talked about her background in organizing, her role in philanthropy, and some of the challenges and opportunities that foundations face in moving resources to Black and Brown communities. We connected via Zoom, and I'm excited to share that conversation with you.
Amaka, it is so wonderful to talk with you, and I'm so grateful you made the time because you are an especially busy woman. You actually have two job titles. You're both the CEO of the Katali Foundation and the director of the Restorative Economies Fund, which was built around the restorative economics framework that you designed and pioneered. I know that you arrived at that framework after many years in community organizing, and I'm hoping you can tell me a little bit about how you got started in this work.
Jessica, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to share a bit more about our work with Katali, the Restorative Economies Fund, and myself. But to address your first question, I think, you know, I would just really couch our entire conversation in the understanding that I come to this work as an organizer, first and foremost. And one of the things I observed early on in my organizing background, both professionally and as a volunteer, was that so much of the ways that Black, Brown, Indigenous communities, communities of color, those that are disproportionately impacted by a whole slew of systems, most of the ways that they have the tools to be able to live with dignity, live with autonomy, is by pushing back against the forces that seek to oppress their communities, right? So this looks like organizing against policy. This looks like pushing back against developers. The other tool in the toolbox oftentimes is then about how do we elect those representatives that we hope will enact progressive policies that also support our communities. And so for me, in some of my work with the Green Collar Jobs campaign, when I worked at the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and worked on a few different campaigns there, also worked on community-based urban development strategies, really recognize that those tools are really limited. And so much of those tools require Black, Brown, Indigenous communities to give over or relinquish their governing power to other forces, to other people. And so I wanted to really sit with the question of, what are the ways or the strategies in which those that are most directly impacted, movement also talks about this as being those that are closest to the pain, are also those that are closest to the solutions. And how can we engage them not just as the people who have the answers and the solutions and then will then take those solutions and enact them, but actually the builders, the designers, the developers of their communities. And so for me, restorative economics is informed by so much of the wins and a lot of the losses from issue-based campaigns, from policies that we've worked on, from even trying to hold elected officials accountable and trying to really understand what are the things, the inputs that communities need to be able to build dignified and thriving livelihoods for themselves and for their communities. And one of the missing pieces that I found far too often around the policies that we'd advocate for or the demands communities would call from is that there was always a question of where would the resources come from? The resources typically being about capital, the money. How are we going to budget for this? How are we going to allocate for this to be possible? And so restorative economics brings together for me an understanding of the vision of how we actually start to support those that are directly impacted and lifting up their solutions and their designs and actually using them to implement a lot of the strategies and solutions for how we transition out of an extractive and exploitative economy And also recognizing that part of how we get there needs to be with an understanding of the need to redistribute resources back into those communities so that they not only have the decision-making power, but then they also have the resources to implement the decisions that they're seeking to make for themselves. And so restorative economics was actually something I just designed for myself. It was something that I designed to really support my consulting practice. And it was a way to kind of signal to clients and organizations that wanted to work with me that this is the work that I am up to in the world. And so since then, I've been fortunate enough that the framework has resonated with some movement groups, some community-based organizations, and is what allowed me to then kind of really launch my consulting practice. And it's been a helpful way to engage in a conversation with donors, impact investors, and philanthropy around how do we intentionally redistribute resources back into Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities. And so those are kind of the origin stories of the work of restorative economics and the framework. And the framework itself, I would say, is rooted in a number of principles. But the key ones that I would lift up is that we seek to support community-owned and community-governed projects, and those that are rooted in the social movements of their local communities. And so we want to support economic models that create shared prosperity. We want to support communities that are coming together to govern together over the resources that they need, and recognizing that these strategies are ultimately about shifting power, shifting the political, economic, and cultural power. And so how are these efforts, whether they are community redevelopment projects, community governed loan funds, continue to be rooted and responsive to the social movements that are contesting for power, that are pushing back on these barriers, and that are making it possible for us to actually envision and ultimately build the strategies of what we want for our communities going forward?
That is so exciting to hear about how you sort of transitioned from everything you got from community organizing and really brought that into a framework that is pretty transformative in terms of how we think about wealth and power. So I'd love to fast forward a few years. I heard about you going from being an organizer to being a consultant. How did you meet Regan Pritzker and her husband, Chris Olin, and transition into the current chapter that you're in as part of the Katali Foundation?
Yes, meeting Regan and Chris has changed my life. I had the pleasure of meeting Regan first, and it was actually connecting with Regan and also connecting with Crystal Haley with the Libra Foundation. And so Regan had been intentionally in right relationship with a number of social movements and organizations, particularly those in the just transition economy space and movement. And so we had the opportunity to be in spaces together through gatherings and conferences. And particularly, I had the pleasure of facilitating one gathering for a group called Shake the Foundations. This brought together a number of progressive foundations and philanthropists and movement groups really committed to just transition that we're really trying to figure out how do we radically shift the field of philanthropy. And so it was through some of those early interactions with Regan and also connecting with Regan through the work of Restore Oakland. Libra Foundation was actually an early grant supporter of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights and therefore the Restore Oakland project. That they invited me in to actually pilot a project in which we would take the restorative economics framework and use it to design what's called an integrated capital fund. So a fund where we're moving not just grants, but also non-extractive or some in the finance field may call them concessionary loans to be able to support community wealth building initiatives. And so we had started actually piloting and working on the design of this fund when the family received a set of returns. And when they received these set of returns, Regan, in partnership with her partner, Chris Olin, decided that they were actually going to redistribute these resources back into communities, back into community wealth building projects. And so I just want to really lift up here that, and I hope at some point you have the opportunity to chat with Regan because I think her story is really beautiful. It was because Regan had been in direct relationship with community organizers, with organizers that were really spending time to educate other funders and donors in the field, that when Regan received these returns, she had already made a commitment to redistributing this portion of her wealth. And it was through that early commitment that the Kautali Foundation was created. And so I have the pleasure of working with Regan and Chris and Susan Pritzker as the board members of the Kautali Foundation. And within the Kautali Foundation, in addition to the Restorative Economies Fund, we also have our Environmental Justice Resourcing Collective, which is designed as a community grant-making vehicle, where we have 9 women of color leaders from the environmental justice movement that not only set the grant-making strategy, but make the decisions on the grant amounts and the grantees for that body of work. And then we also have our Mindfulness and Healing Justice Program area, where we also have a set of practitioner funders that come together to really figure out how do we support Black, Indigenous, and communities of color that traditionally don't have access into the contemplative and mindfulness practices to be able to have the resources that they need to not only engage in the practices, but have the space to heal and to repair and then bring those tools and strategies back to their communities. And so that's kind of how we all came to be. I would offer that it is similar to the Restorative Economies Fund. We had our Mindfulness and Healing Justice Program area and our Environmental Justice Resourcing Collective that were kind of operating connected but independently. And it was in 2020 that we actually decided, let's the three of these programs come together under the heading of the Kautali Foundation. And so we're really lucky to have such a deeply rooted origin story that's based and informed by social movements and those that have been working towards a just transition.
I love how you've talked about the origin story as bringing together movement practitioners, because I think the culture that you've built at the Kautali Foundation is pretty different than a lot of foundation organization staff cultures. And you've been sort of creating it in a really intentional way. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the process that you've gone through to help a group of activists and movement leaders become program officers and funders? What has that been like for your relationships with each other? And what have you learned about it that might be useful for other foundations?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. Thanks for even that observation. We are really intentional about the team that we're trying to build. And I oftentimes joke with people and say that while philanthropy wasn't part of my vision board, it wasn't part of the 10-year plan, I'm really honored and happy that we can be here with the team that we have. We look at building up a team that we refer to as practitioner funders. And for us, what that means is we hire our team, particularly our program staff, of people that come out of a lived and movement experience and having done this work on the ground. And this is important to us for a number of reasons. It's important to us because we want to engage and support people that understand the challenges the grassroots communities face when they're actually trying to do this work on the ground, and that their understanding and their experiences and having engaged these challenges then inform how we show up as a funder. And so our questions are not to find a reason not to fund the projects. We ask questions to understand, how do we ensure that you were successful and that you win? And then how do we move resources accordingly to that? And how do we need to also continue to show up to be in just and right relationship for your ongoing success and victory? And this is because we really do take to heart the call for collective liberation, and that when grassroots communities win and do well, we all win and do well. The other reason we think it's important to hire practitioner funders for our work is that while we are focused on moving the resources to these communities, what I know to be true that sits in that racial wealth gap, right? We talk about the racial wealth gap and we put the dollars and cents to it. But what also sits within that are a set of policies and practices designed to keep Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities from having access to the knowledge, the expertise, the networks, the relationships that are also necessary to be able to live with autonomy and dignity. And so having a practitioner funder team means that we also have people that are able to move the resources, but are also able to share their skills, their knowledge, their expertise with these communities as well. And so for the grantees that are interested in us reviewing their performa and offering feedback and engaging in their strategy, we welcome that. And we think that we have a responsibility to redistribute that knowledge as much as we have a responsibility to redistribute that wealth. I think the last piece I'll say here around why it's important for us to really lean into our practitioner funder is that we know that as we are calling for the decolonization of philanthropy, and as we're calling for an end to white supremacy, that unfortunately, these systems are internalized within us as individuals and within philanthropy as a field, as an institution. And so our work every day has to be, how are we challenging and questioning where and how those practices show up and where and how we can do better. And we don't seek to do this from a way of proclaiming that we have it all figured out. We seek to do it with an understanding that we are sitting in the contradictions of navigating the very same systems that we live within. And so what does it mean to be very honest, transparent, and move with integrity and accountability about the ways that those systems impact us as individuals within our institution, in philanthropy, where we challenge them in doing them better, and where are some of the places where we may just have hit a block. And so for all of these reasons, we really want to hold a team that is recognizes the humanity of our program team, recognizes our commitment to justice and equity, and that we are also doing our best in trying to figure out how we move. And when we can do all of those things, we find that that actually creates a way of being in the world and creates a level of relationship and a channel of communication with our grantees, where our grantees actually trust to give us a call and give us feedback and let us know where they think we could be pivoting, we could be doing things differently, we could be doing things better. And we find that being in integrity with ourselves and with our grantees is what then makes it possible for us to not just have trust-based philanthropy, but trust-based philanthropy that's deeply rooted in a mutuality of relationships that go back and forth. And so, yeah, I'm really honored to have the team that we do. I really would love to invite people to kind of go to our website and read the bios of our team members, because one thing that I'm really clear about is we want team members that are committed to a level of excellence, with an understanding that excellence is not that we are perfect, but excellence is that we are doing our very best and we're willing to learn from our mistakes and evolve. And I think we have a really great team that's modeling that.
So much to unpack there. I think that reframing the perfectionism that is inherent in white supremacist culture, which is inherent in most of philanthropy in the social sector, as a focus on excellence is so powerful. And I love also how you talk about right relationship, because I think what that implies, particularly when it's between funders and folks who are seeking resources, is a level of mutuality and mutual accountability that is a pretty big reframe from how a lot of philanthropy is practiced. I'm wondering how this has been for you on a personal level. I think most of us who are in philanthropy haven't always been. And I think for me, it was a little bit of a bumpy transition from the nonprofit sector to becoming a donor and donor advisor. What has this done for your relationships, and what might you offer in terms of thinking about how to navigate a transition?
Yeah, this might be the portion where we go into a little bit of a therapy session. Yeah, I think to start off, I appreciate you naming the piece around power, because what I've observed in the field of philanthropy, both from someone who sat outside of it and now that somebody that is inside of it, is that oftentimes philanthropy tries to act or pretend as if we don't have power. And there's this weird abdication of power that doesn't serve anyone. It doesn't serve our grantees. It doesn't serve ourselves. And so, but when we're clear about where we have power and how we're stewarding it, then we can recognize a level of responsibility under which we move. And so all of that to say, I would say that this position, being a CEO of Catali and working alongside Chris Regan and Susan and my colleagues, is a level of power and authority that I have never had access to or experienced in my life as a Black woman, and as a Black woman that sits at a number of intersecting identities. And it is a level of power and positionality that my family doesn't understand. We continue to, I was talking to my dad last night. He's like, I still don't understand what you do. It sounds like you're happy doing it. So I cheer you on. I kind of lift those pieces up because what it means is that I have a responsibility to recognize and own how I have power. And so even though with the foundation, even though our program leads and our practitioner funders make the grant making decisions around who we move resources to and how that moves, and I do that also with the Restorative Economies Fund as a collective, there is a level of power that I have within the institution. There's a level of power that I have in the field and with our grantees. And so this requires me to move with a level of awareness, responsibility, and sensitivity. And what this means is that some of the spaces where, you know, I just want to show up as me, myself, and I, sometimes that shifts, sometimes that changes, right? I am learning that when I endorse an event, some people will take that endorsement as, oh, this is a place that we should be in, or this is a place that we should fund or invest in. I have never been asked to endorse events before that. And so I'm recognizing that when I say or do things, it has an impact on the field, which requires me to move with a level of diligence in how I engage. I also think what this means for me is also the responsibility to do the best that I can in this role, just to be honest, right? This is a very unique opportunity to actually enact the types of philanthropic strategies that social movements have been calling for. And so as somebody who comes out of social movement, as somebody who understands what those demands are, Kitali, we have a responsibility to do our best to remain responsive to those calls. And so what does it mean to then leverage my power to make decisions that allow us to move forward and model that for the rest of the field? One of the things I do really appreciate about the power of this role, just to be honest, is that it does also mean that those that I have been in relationship with through the organizations and social movements that I've been honored to be a part of, they will actually call me up. I've actually had a couple of calls already in less than a year of being in this position where people have offered me feedback. And that feedback is extremely helpful because it always helps to ground me that the places where I may be underestimating my impact or how I'm showing up actually is impacting the field in some way. And so that intentional relationship building where people will give the feedback, not as a way to cancel me or throw me away, but as a way to actually figure out, Amaka, how do we support you in continuing to do the work that we as a movement have been calling for, is something that I deeply appreciate. And so, I think power is an interesting thing. I continue to sit with interesting ways in which some of the people that would not talk to me or would not engage with me when I was an organizer or when I was a consultant now will engage with me now is in my role as a CEO. And, you know, I can't be bitter about that. I still have to show up and go and do the work. And so, I think I'm learning to navigate all the ways in which I have to have an awareness of my power, all the ways in which I may have to know that it's necessary for me to recuse myself from some movement spaces where I otherwise would have been a part of and may have to take a step back, but knowing that it's not a diminishing of me, but it's actually a supporting of the integrity of those social movement spaces. And so I feel like I rambled a little bit, but those are the ways that I'm learning all of what it means to have power in this position, both within Kitali, but also within the field of philanthropy.
Yeah, it's so interesting that the prerequisite for being able to give power away is to acknowledge that you have it and figure out how to hold it responsibly. And that's so much more work than I think many of us realize. You know, Kitali is getting a lot of attention and admiration because it really might be the only foundation of its size that's focused on shifting power and resources to Black and Brown communities. And that's not one of its approaches or one of its values or one of its program areas, but its core mission. And of course, it should go without saying, but this was in the works a long time before George Floyd last summer, right? And so I would love to hear a little bit about what made that possible, what paved the way sort of conceptually for this work to exist. And then I have some more questions about how other foundations can sort of catch up or bridge that gap, but just would love to think a little bit about sort of heritage.
Yes. So our deep focus to redistribute resources to support the political, economic, and cultural power of Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities and all communities of color, I think this comes back to the practitioner funder piece. When we hire a team, starting with myself, I was technically the first employee, that comes not just from a representation of a group, but a lived in movement experience of a group, we come with an understanding of what does it mean to resource those that have been most directly impacted. And so early on and through my organizing work, I've really come to understand and see the ways that typical policies and practices, if they are not intentional, if they're not specific and targeted about who they resource, how they resource them, and then what they're resourcing, they continue to miss over the Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities of color. And that's because of all the things that we know about systemic inequities and structural racism. And so we actually need to be very specific and clear about what we're trying to resource and the ways that we're trying to resource them. And that is why we decided to bake this into our DNA as a foundation from the offset. We wanted to be a foundation that was really clear that we understand the inherent contradictions and how private philanthropy can come to exist, right? The extraction of wealth and resources consolidated within an institution or a set of individuals. And that in understanding that contradiction, our responsibility then is to intentionally redistribute those resources back out into those communities. And so when we just kind of are indirect or unspecific about what we're trying to resource, we won't hit the mark because resources are not designed to meet the needs of immigrant communities. They're not designed to meet the needs of Black communities or those that are formerly incarcerated. And so all of this is why from the offset, we are very clear and explicit about what we're up to with our work, that we want to build community wealth for those that have not had access to those resources before. We want to support and address the intersecting causes of environmental justice for those that are hit first and worst by climate change. And we want to ensure that our communities are not always going through burnout, that they're able to move with a level of intentionality and mindfulness. And so those were all the things that were baked into our heritage as a foundation. And what we have found is that when we resource those community leaders that are on the ground, it has actually started to create access to other forms of resource and capital for those projects. And so I'm really excited about the way that our level of specificity and unapologetic reinvestment into Black and Brown and Indigenous communities is starting to be a new method, a way of thinking about how do we actually correct the hurt and harms of philanthropy, of our economic systems, and start to do something that is more transformative, not just for the grassroots communities, but understanding when we target the problem at the source, at the root, we actually create something where the entire system can thrive for all of us. And that is why this level of specificity and being targeted and intentional in who we resource is part of our strategy.
That makes a lot of sense. What about being a spend down foundation? I'm seeing definitely a trend in folks deciding to deploy their resources over, 10, 15, 20 years, as opposed to creating perpetual foundations. And that is definitely the Katali model. Why is that important and relevant for you?
Yeah, the spend out piece is always an interesting conversation. And as we enter in this piece, I just want people to hopefully hold my comments at the level of nuance. So one of the things that I would like enter into this conversation around a spend out is people will probably recall that oftentimes community organizers, grassroots organizers on the ground will talk about how they're trying to work themselves out of a job, right? They're trying to work themselves out of having to fight police brutality, of having to shut down oil refineries. And in that same breath, then we have philanthropy that has a mission to exist into perpetuity, right? And so this one goal of a group of people committed to justice and equity that are trying to work themselves out of a job and another that wants to exist into perpetuity, there is a gap in values and strategies there that we actually need to uncover. And sometimes the spend out conversation is a way that allows us the flexibility to actually align ourselves more directly with the goal of social movement and community organizers, because if we understand that they're trying to work themselves out of a job, then it requires us to resource them in a way that we believe that they can win, which may mean we have to relinquish, redistribute some of our resources. And one of the things that we really tried to lift up at Kitali is that the spend out piece is what allows us the flexibility to prioritize the wins and victories of our grantees over the financial returns back to our foundation. And so particularly with our integrated capital strategy, we seek to fund projects so that they are financially sustainable, so that they can exist and continue to go on. What we know to be true, though, is that we think their revenue, their returns, should not come back to the foundation for our own accumulation and enclosure of that wealth, but those resources should continue to recirculate out into the community. And so being a spend out foundation just allows us that flexibility to prioritize the impact over the investment and over the return. The other piece that is important for us is that it allows us the flexibility to know that our success as a foundation is not predicated on our perpetuity. It is not predicated on the growth of our endowment. Our success is predicated on the impact and the transformation that we can see out in communities. And so sometimes it can be a third rail conversation to talk about spend out for foundations where that actually, that word can be a trigger for your board, for your team, if it doesn't work. I invite people to just lean into talking about how do we maximize the impact for communities on the ground? Sometimes that may mean we need to actually challenge our credit policy. If our credit policy to sustain a 3-4% on PRIs isn't actually meeting the needs of communities on the ground, the type of investments that they need, then let's open up that conversation. But if we are always tied more to our credit policies and our own endowment than we are to those communities that we proclaim to support and be a part of, I think that is where the misalignment is. And we need to be able to look at that boldly. So coming out of the uprisings from last summer, and when we saw so many philanthropies and impact investment firms make a commitment to resourcing social movements, resourcing Black communities specifically, now we're seeing that a lot of those commitments have not come forth. People have not made good on them. And so what does it take for us to actually put our feet to the fire to show up and be who we claim to be and who we understand ourselves to be, both as individuals, but also as institutions? For me, at the end of the day, if Kitali is still standing, and people are still dying from police brutality, if young people are still being locked up at the border, if people are still struggling to make ends meet, that is not a win to me. And so we are more interested in figuring out how do we support communities in winning and having the autonomy, the authority to really live with dignity. I guess I can't say it enough. So whether it's spend out or perpetuity, asking yourself, what is the ultimate impact that we're having that is rooted in transformation and not just transaction or incremental change is what I would invite people to kind of do an inward look to.
Yeah, it's interesting. Earlier in our conversation, you mentioned concessionary returns, and then you quickly reframe that as non-extractive returns. And it's so interesting because from the investor's standpoint, it's like, oh, that's not market rate, that's concessionary. But actually, market rate returns are often based on extractive practices. And so from the investee's standpoint, really reframing as this is not a concession, this is a reorientation towards not extractive, I feel like is really powerful. And that's the conversation that is sort of, to me, the next frontier in impact investing that folks are really just starting to get their heads around.
And part of the reason the non-extractive piece is important as well, Jessica, is we've had people like Jessica Norwood from Runway Project really speak to the racial wealth gap. And the racial wealth gap, as I mentioned before, yes, it's about grants. It's also about skills and expertise and what it takes for a community that has not had access to capital before, that cannot get access to the business loans, that was missed over for the PPP loans, means that they do need a level of investment, but they can't meet those market rate returns, particularly not in their early stages. And I would argue sometimes they shouldn't, because that money should stay in their communities.
Yeah.
But all that to say, if we're able to actually structure non-extractive investments, this is what kickstarts the engine of a local economy. And we can't actually transform society just based on 501c3s. We actually need to be investing in other vehicles that we know help to generate resources and returns that continue to exist and grow out in the community. And that's why we think an investment strategy is also a critical part of the work that we're up to in Kitale.
Is there a one example? I don't mean to have you pick your favorite grantee or investee, but there's so much that is exciting in practice that you've identified and helped to support. Do you have an example that you want to share?
Sure. A project that I've really loved being reacquainted with is a project called Historic Claiborne Temple. It's out of Memphis, Tennessee. And Anasa Troutman is the executive director of Claiborne Temple. And for those that don't know, Claiborne Temple was the church where the sanitation strikers organized prior to the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. at the Lorraine Hotel. And so Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. actually came, was with the sanitation workers at this church in Memphis that really supported a lot of the I Am a Man campaign work. And so this is a building that has fallen into disrepair. And Anasa, and working closely with other community leaders and organizations, has taken up the bold mission to really figure out, how do we restore this building, this site that is a legacy of the civil rights movement, and it's also a beacon for the regenerative economy movement going forward in the midst of the city of Memphis that is under a lot of redevelopment. And so how can the redevelopment of Historic Claiborne Temple be an anchor, not just for the long-term Black residents of the area, but also as a way of modeling and challenging what equitable economic development can look like when it's done well. And so Anasa is in the process of working with a number of community leaders and organizations to also figure out how to structure the ownership and the governance of the building so that those that are descendants of the sanitation strikers can also be a part of the ownership model, can also be a part of the governing board in addition to those long-term residents. And so this is a project that we're excited to support because it starts to touch on what redevelopment rooted in community can look like. It really honors the culture and the history of a people in a place, and it then creates a site for people to come together and gather and re-envision what redevelopment across Memphis can look like, particularly redevelopment that centers those long-term Black residents. And so Kitale, at the end of 2019, we moved an initial grant to support the acquisition of the site. And then we came back in 2021, we closed on a loan, a non-extractive reconstruction loan to Historic Claiborne Temple. And we were also able to do that in partnership with the Olamina Fund from Candide Group. And so these are the places where we're excited to partner with values aligned funds and foundations that also want to come in and provide the type of non-extractive investments into communities. And so in addition to moving grants, moving the loans, we also continue to support their funder briefings. Even prior to the acquisition of the site, Lynn Hoy from Candide Group and I went to Memphis and actually spoke to a number of local foundations in Memphis, really lifting up why Kitale was interested in supporting Historic Claiborne Temple and inviting the rest of them to support as well. And what we've seen in Historic Claiborne Temple is that by supporting this visionary project and NASA's leadership, it's made it possible for the city to come and start to have a conversation around some other sites that are also a part of the Promise Zone areas to start to think about how do we ensure community ownership and governance over these sites. And then next door, a community orange mound also has a vision of having a community owned redevelopment project, and so also supporting leaders like Victoria Jones adjacent to Anasa, who are also kind of taking up this vision for equitable development. So by resourcing Historic Claiborne Temple, we've seen the way that the project has magnified and made possible for people to envision and understand that, yes, this work can actually be done differently, and it can be rooted in community, and it can be done in a values-aligned ways. And so I would really invite people to watch for the work of Historic Claiborne Temple. One thing I'll offer on this piece around one story, and I know I just like squeezed in three stories within one, but one of the things that I'm really that gives me hope is that in the face of the continuing deployment of the stimulus funds and the infrastructure bill that has just been announced, philanthropy has a really unique opportunity to do a lot of the capacity building and readiness on the ground that helps to support Black and Brown communities to be at the forefront of securing these federal dollars that help to make possible so much of what they have been calling for. And so if philanthropy can be the first investors, the first supporters, we then make it possible for these communities that oftentimes get overlooked, like we saw in the case of the PPP loans, to have the capacity to secure the resources. So we're in an incredible opportune moment as philanthropy to put our resources where the movements are at. And I would invite folks to think about what it looks like to support projects like Historic Claiborne Temple that may be in their local community, that may even already be within their docket that they're just not aware of just yet, and figure out how that can start to really transform our economy.
That's amazing. I think you and I are probably both working towards a world where philanthropy doesn't exist, but in the meantime, what is it good for? And being able to fund capacity building, but also sort of have that risk capital to be able to create projects that demonstrate that another world and another model is possible, feels like such an incredible role for philanthropy to play. And I think what I hear you saying is now more than ever, right? Because of some of the urgency. Do you have any advice? I feel like I've had a bunch of conversations with folks who are like, oh my God, the Kitale Foundation is so amazing. I wish my foundation were doing that, or I wish I could get my giving to be much more equity focused. And folks are, you know, trying to catch up. Do you have advice for others who are earlier on their journey?
I'm happy to offer advice. If I think what comes up for me is, you know, when we started the conversation, Jessica, you asked me about my journey from an organizer to consultant and now with Kitale. And I would offer that organizing is a part of all the roles that I've held as a consultant within philanthropy. And so I think that we need to, as a field, be more intentional about what it means to be organizers. And if we could learn from some of the best, it means listening, it means really providing the level of education, but it also means challenging. So I would invite those that actually want to create this type of shift and change within their institution to learn and think and move like an organizer and to have that level of intentionality in how we engage. I would lift up that Farhad Ibrahimi, the executive director of Chorus Foundation, just launched an article today on The Forge that really talks about the need to be explicit about organizing within philanthropy. And I actually have a piece coming out in a little bit that lifts up, as particularly as program officers, our role is to be organizers. Our role is to not become so tied to being in proximity to power and wealth that we compromise our values, but that we continue to push. So yes, I would say be an organizer. I would also say for larger institutions that are just not kind of sold on the integrated capital, non-extractive investment, I would say set aside a set of resources. Maybe it's 5 million, maybe it's 5%, maybe it's less than. And experiment with actually doing the work. There's a lot to be said from learning by doing. And so make a commitment to figure out, yeah, what does it look like to try this on? As facilitators, we oftentimes invite people to try things on let's try on as a field first before we say no. And this is all because what we have been doing has not created the level of transformation that we know we need. There is a level of urgency upon us, given all the compounding crises that we are aware of. And in order to address that urgency, we do need to actually, as counterintuitive as it may be, slow down and move intentionally through addressing the challenges and not just continue to do more of the same. So those are some of the things that I would offer for those, some of the suggestions or advice I'd offer for those that want to learn how to do this work. And I would say at Kitali, we welcome partnerships with those that have already done the level of internal work where they're now ready to move resources. And so we are always happy to have foundations or donors accompany us as we look to move capital into a number of projects, and happy to share our learnings with folks as we go.
Thank you. Incredibly generous. I would love to end on a personal note, because this work is exhausting. To be launching a new foundation, to be responding with rapid response grant dockets to several emergencies over the course of 2020 and now into 2021, you have the unique role of leading a foundation that actually has a mindfulness grant-making portfolio as part of its docket. I'm wondering if you have any sort of resources that you turn to focus on cultivating the emotional stamina to do this work. How do you keep yourself sane?
Am I sane? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, no, it's a good question. To be honest, I find that physical activity is something that really gives me the endurance that I need for the work. And so Peloton is one of the things I picked up during the pandemic and really enjoy it, as well as weightlifting. But to your piece around the emotional stamina, early on, I think, I don't know what year it was, many years ago, I participated in the Black Organizers for Leadership and Dignity training, where they focus on somatics work. And so the bold space continues to be kind of one of, not necessarily a movement space, but a somatic practitioner space that I get to go back to in terms of being recharged and reminded about the work that I'm up to. And I would also say the stuff that keeps me emotionally sane is I intentionally engage with social movements outside of my paid work. And so it's actually being rooted in working alongside organizers, working on local campaigns and volunteering that helps to kind of keep me grounded about what's at stake and in spite of kind of the day-to-day of emails and Zoom meetings. And that, while it sounds like it's more work, it is actually the thing that makes the work real and keeps me grounded in it. And so I would invite folks to also think about, how are you fighting for victory and liberation outside of your paid work? And how is that informing then just kind of a groundedness in what's at stake and how we're moving through it? But lastly, I would say therapy is always a good thing. So I invite people to do therapy. We've all just been through a very hard and challenging year. And so therapy is actually also something that has been keeping me whole and sane throughout all the moments. So, yeah.
Amen. For me too. Well, thank you so much for taking some time to talk with us. And most importantly, thank you for the work that you and the Kitali Foundation are doing and the space that you're holding for not only supporting real power and culture shift, but doing the peer organizing with other donors and having these conversations, which I think is so critical.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.